The views expressed in this program are those of the participants.
What's this?
Food for two for the 8-day work periods.
Food?
It is the diet ordered by the masters. It will sustain life and energy.
Who are the masters?
They are the rulers of this complex. They are all wise. It is my purpose to serve them.
Who else lives here besides the masters?
The workers and soldiers.
Have you ever seen anyone that looked different? Someone like us?
One like you, dressed like you, has been among us for many years.
Where is this man?
I am forbidden to speak about him.
Wait! You've got to help us find him. If we don't, we're in trouble.
What is trouble?
It means something terrible will happen to people we love unless we find this man.
What is love?
Tony, she doesn't relate to us in any way.
She doesn't relate to anything.
Welcome, everyone. It is Wednesday, May 13th, 2026. I'm Bob Metz, and this is Just Right, broadcasting around the world and online. Join us for an hour of discussion that's not right-wing. It's Just Right.
Fade into color, color into black and white. Under the bedclothes, everything will be all right.
Our opener from the classic Time Tunnel TV series is a perfect illustration of what it's like for someone on the right to attempt to communicate with someone on the left. Drowning in the ideology of collectivism, those on the left are incapable of relating to anything, and in particular, to reality itself. One of the mysteries confronting more and more people on the right is how and why so many people living during the most prosperous period in human history and in the freest nation on earth could possibly entertain or embrace the ideology of socialism. Yet this is exactly what all those voting for the Democratic Party in the U.S. or for any of the outright openly visible communists like New York's Mamdani are doing. Most without a clue of what that ideology actually is and represents. So with this disturbing trend in mind, once again we find it critical and necessary to remind one and all of just how evil an ideology socialism actually is. And of course, before we can do that, it is first necessary to define exactly what we mean by the word evil and by its opposite, the good. Which is the first thing that we'll do right after our reminder that you can write us at feedback@justrightmedia.org. Hear us on WBCQ and on Channel 292 Shortwave. Follow and like us on your favorite podcast platform and visit us at justrightmedia.org, where you can access all of our social media links, archive broadcasts, and the support button that makes it easy for you to support the show. Because, as always, your financial support is appreciated and is what makes this show possible. Now, in any credible argument asserting that socialism is evil, it is essential that the meanings of good and evil are clearly defined and expressed. The terms good and evil represent moral opposites, moral polarities, if you will. The standard by which one judges what is good or evil is human life. Since reason is man's basic means of survival, that which is proper to the life of a rational being is the good, and that which negates it, opposes, or destroys it, is the evil. And of course, there are three branches of the good: the intrinsic, the subjectivist, and the objective. The intrinsic view holds that good exists independent of man's consciousness. The subjectivist holds that good is the product of man's consciousness independent of the facts of reality. And the objective view is that the good is an evaluation of the facts of reality by man's consciousness according to a rational standard of value. Notice that good and evil are not things, quote-unquote, however one might physically or mentally represent them. Good and evil are evaluations, matters of judgment, and this brings us to the fundamental meaning of morality and ethics itself. In this regard, ethics is an objective, metaphysical necessity of man's survival. In fact, the whole idea or concept of morality or ethics is meaningless without the objective being human survival or flourishing and well-being. But morality and ethics are just the third branch of philosophy's hierarchy, with metaphysics and epistemology being the first two. However, the fourth branch of philosophy is politics, where the labels that separate and distinguish between the ideas and actions that are destructive to human life from those that are constructive to human life are properly referred to as left and right. We aren't just joking whenever we say that the left is a death cult, which is why we insist on being just right. Over and over again, though, I keep hearing many on the true right say something like, "This isn't about left and right," and then they fill in the blank with their latest political issue that invariably proves their statement incorrect. Within moments of denying the left-right polarity, you'll hear them using those very labels throughout whatever political issue they're discussing. They're unavoidable. And that's because the people who assert this are equating the terms left and right with various political parties or labels like Democrat versus Republican, liberal versus conservative, or other various political movements who are strictly in opposition to one another on the political stage, if not in ideology. Worse, they've bought into the so-called political spectrum, with communism and socialism on the left and fascism on the right. And of course, that's a complete fiction. And on this point, you'll no doubt understand exactly what I mean as we approach the fourth quarter of today's broadcast. But just one or two more points before we kick off today's broader discussion about the evil that is socialism. And first, it has to be asserted that communism, socialism, fascism, and all other variants of collectivism are essentially the same thing and are all properly identified and labeled as being on the left. Collectivism refers to the subjugation of the individual to a group, whether it's to a race, a class, or a state is irrelevant. Collectivism holds that the individual has no rights and that his life and work belong to the group. The only way to implement a doctrine of that kind is by means of brute force. And secondly, when we speak of government, always, it must never be forgotten that what is being governed is the use of force. And that brings us to our main exhibit of collectivist brute force in action. And it's right on America's doorstep, namely the nightmarish dystopian country called Cuba. That's spelled C-U-B-A, which is a perfect acronym for communism under brutal authority. And to kick off today's discussion, Patrick Bet-David, on his May 7th podcast, got the first scoop on Nick Shirley's recent, as he put it, escape from Cuba. It was a chilling account, and anyone hearing it for the first time may miss the nuances and the sheer horror of what life is like under communism, which is merely, again, one variant of collectivism alongside socialism and fascism.
Nick Shirley, how you doing?
Amazing.
Good seeing you again. You just got back from Cuba. Out of all the places you can go to, why Cuba?
I've been wanting to go to Cuba for the past year or so.
Okay.
Because I've been tracking like the rise of communism, socialism here inside the United States. Mm-hmm. And so I've been wanting to make a video for a long time going to a communist country to show people what life is like inside a communist country. And so I just hopped on the flight, bought my ticket, and coordinated with security. Everyone was telling me, Nick, do not go. My parents were like, do not go. Security was like, Nick, do not go. Everyone was telling me do not go. I was like, well, I'm going to go because like people deserve to see what's happening. And so I went and, yeah, almost got taken hostage.
You almost got taken hostage while you're there.
Yeah. So it's just me and two of my security guards. One's actually a Cuban-American, and the other one also speaks Spanish. So I had two guys who spoke Spanish. I also speak fluent Spanish. And so these guys I went with, they had done operations, like anti-human trafficking operations in Haiti and Mexico. And so they're very well versed in these hostile situations. When we arrived to the airport, we had done everything correct. I had my visa, and it was for journalistic activities. And I get there, and right as I get there, they take all my... I only brought two GoPros and some DJI microphones. They take all of that. And my Meta glasses as well. However, luckily, I had a very small microphone that I had at the very bottom of my backpack, and the guy's finger just like scuffed it. He didn't notice that I had that microphone. So I had my iPhone, and these people were literally, we were with them for probably 1 to 2 hours as they were trying to figure out what we were doing. And I was telling him, I'm just here to make a video. Like I said, like I have my visa right here, and just want to show people what's going on here in Cuba. And it turned into kind of a big ordeal where they brought in like a bunch of other people to come ask me questions and touch the gear, seeing what was, it was like foreign objects to them, like the meta glasses. They were like analyzing the meta glasses like they, like some crazy foreign object.
Because they've never seen it before.
Yeah.
That stuff's not going to be out there.
And then they're asking me, what kind of videos do you make? I was like, well, I just go around the world showing people what's going on with journalism. And I told them my name. And then one of the ladies said, he's up to no good. Like, Trump probably sent him or something like that. Because I was the only American in the airport.
Yeah.
Like, I'm the only gringo there. And I have these two security guards with me.
Interesting. So they took, did you get anything back or no? The cameras, all this stuff?
I ended up getting it back when I left the airport the next day. I was planning on being there for 3 days, and it turned into 24 hours.
So everything you shot and recorded is on an iPhone?
Yeah.
Huh. iPhone and one of those mics.
Mm-hmm.
So now while you're in the airport, who else is coming to you? Is other security coming? Is there intel coming? Is the military showing up? Is it a big spectacle, or is it fairly low-key in a different private room where nobody sees it?
No, it was out in the open. So right as I get there, they then take me back to this different area. And from there, they had two people working this desk, and then they ended up bringing in three other people. And there was like the boss of the airport and then two other people that they were literally writing everything down on a piece of paper. Like, they don't have computers inside of the airport, so they're literally writing everything down, pen and paper. And the paper is not even a sheet of paper. It's a receipt.
You didn't see one computer in the airport?
No. It was all pen and paper.
So now, when you leave the airport, are they following you? Do you feel like people around trying to watch to see what you're there for?
Well, as soon as we leave the airport, we're getting followed. What people don't realize about communism is everyone is essentially working for the government if they have a job, especially in a location like an airport,
mm-hmm.
especially at the hotels as well. So, like, it creates a whole entire society where everyone just snitches on each other, because then that helps them. And nobody knows about that. No one speaks about that, about communism. Like, you only hear that from people who escaped North Korea.
Very interesting. So now you're leaving. How quickly do you start creating content and taking the camera out?
About 2 hours. I get to the hotel, check in. Yeah, the guy at the hotel lobby actually knew who I was. He's like, oh, Nick Shirley.
How does he know you?
From Facebook. He's like, oh, your videos in Minnesota were great. And he was a super cool guy. So there's some cool people in the airport. This guy was super cool, and he put us in a super nice hotel room. That was super awesome. But then there was these other people, like there's this older guy who then took us on a tour, and he was just like completely lying about everything about Cuba. I'm like, so is this a communist country? He's like, no, socialist. We're socialists. But there's only one party in Cuba. And that's
communism.
Communist Party of Cuba.
Give me what you're seeing in the streets. What are the cars? What are the properties looking like? What are the people, what they're wearing? Phones, watches. What did you notice?
Streets are empty. Buildings are decaying. A lot of them are turning into like rubble. And there's no cars in the streets. And the cars they have are from like the 1950s. And if any of the other cars they do have, they're Chinese or from the Soviet area. Mass poverty. And everyone's just trying to get some dollars. Like, it's super, super, super sad.
What was something that you expected? What was surprising? What was good? What was bad? Walk me through what you saw. Well, maybe you're like, you know what? I was surprised. This is what I liked about it. This is what you know, was concerning about it.
I expected to see like poverty. I've been to South America. I lived in South America. I expected to see that. I didn't expect to see Latinos so depressed.
Why do you say that?
There was like no life in the eyes of a lot of these people. What is going on? Like, a lot of the women wouldn't even look you in the eyes. Like, they're just very depressed. Like, even at the airport, the women that were working at the airport, they were so depressed. And even the men as well, like, there's just no hope for these people. And so that was what really took me back, was seeing all these people that were just depressed, and there was like no life in their eyes. And then seeing like some of the the architecture that they had. Like, Cuba used to have like the prettiest architecture. Like, I imagine in the 1950s it was just beautiful, and now you're seeing like the decay, and it looks awful there. Like, everything just literally looks like rubble. It looks like some sort of war zone. Like, look at the architecture on that. Like, super pretty. It looks like something you'd see, like some of the moldings and stuff look like when you're walking the streets of Paris.
Mm-hmm.
And so to see that, and you've seen the what it could look like, is very depressing. What percentage of people do you think are suffering here in Cuba?
La mayoría. La mayoría.
What's your thoughts on communism? ¿Qué piensas de comunismo?
De lo más malo que ha existido en la vida es el comunismo.
Wow, so they're that public
about it. Porque realmente ninguna comunista.
None of the gas stations are even in operation right now because there's quite literally no gas.
And we stand out like sore thumbs here, so they're wondering why we're here with cameras, interviewing people. They want to know what's happening and what
Who's
people
he?
Are saying. That's why people are not talking.
Under security.
They're asking why are we trying to leave the hotel early.
Cuba right now is facing one of the largest humanitarian crises in the world. Cuba's government is a one-party communist-ruled country, and they are facing massive food shortages, daily blackouts, and a lack of medicine. And right now, a U.S. blockade is restricting oil and gas from coming inside of the country. With communism and socialism on the rise in the West, I wanted to see what life in communism is really like firsthand, as Cuba has been living underneath communism for over 60 years. Upon arrival, I completed all required documents and had received a visa for journalistic activity. However, once I landed, all my camera gear was seized, and within 24 hours, I was planning my escape out of Cuba after their intelligence followed me all day and a two-star general came searching for me at the hotel. Now,
two-star
let's go
general?
See the reality yeah. of Cuba and eventually plan our escape out of Cuba.
Nick, let me ask you, do they have internet? Meaning, are they able to watch YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, TikTok, or are they able to consume news?
They do, but they have to do it illegally. They have to use a VPN.
Got it.
So actually, if you want to watch a TV show, you have to go into a booth and then they run it like on a hard drive and they give you a disc.
What do you mean?
Like, they have these weird booths. So if you want to watch media or TV, you have to go to like a person who then, you know how you, like back in the day, like my dad used to make playlists off of CDs, right?
Mm-hmm.
They do that exact same thing, but for movies and TV shows. And so like right now they're like releasing shows from like the 1990s in the theaters. And in order to even use a theater, you have to have like around at least I think like 9 people inside the theater to watch the show. If not, it just gets cut off. And there's all these blackouts right now with power. So people really aren't consuming much.
What was the strangest answer you got? Like, what was a part where you're like, you cannot believe what somebody opened up and things they shared with you?
One person said they haven't had eggs in a year.
Eggs in a year.
Like, they talk about these books that they have, like, I think they call them, like, their ration book,
uh-huh.
where the government controls how much food they get, and they're like, this is horrible. We haven't even had eggs in a year. It takes it years to get it, eat a chicken. Like, stuff that you wouldn't even think about here in the United States, but because of communism and the government controlling what people can actually do and what they can eat, it dictates their entire life.
What else? Were they saying things like, we can't wait for something to happen? Are you here giving us news? Are we about to be free? Were they seeing like they're pleading for help with you, or they were almost afraid of speaking to you? Because there's two different energies, right?
Both? Yeah, so obviously some people don't want to speak out because they're sick of it. But one of the individuals like, see, this is why it's gotten like this, because we can't speak out. And so people are grateful that you're actually going and showing what's happening. I went all by myself. And then I was supposed to go for about 60 hours. It turned into 24 because they surrounded us at the hotel. So
what was the reasoning for you wanting to turn around? Did you just not feel
safe? My security was like, we got to go. Like,
okay.
They said this is like one of the more risky situations they've ever been in. And this is coming from guys who have gone to Haiti and who have done anti-human trafficking missions in Mexico and in Haiti. So
how easy was it for you to change the flight and come back early? Was that pretty smooth and easy?
It's pretty smooth, but we didn't want to let them know and tip them off that we were leaving early. So I think we booked the flight at like 3 a.m., but it didn't help because when we went down to leave the hotel, the two-star general was waiting for us. And so we went out to go get the taxi, and then the security guard comes. He's like, hey, don't run. They're here. They want to talk to you.
What did they ask you?
It was like a movie. It's hard to even put it into words because the feelings and then also like the scenery of it. It's like the stars on the hat, like everything that you would expect to see from a movie. And they take us back into this room. He has a secretary with us, and he's asking, he's like, hey, why are you guys leaving early? What was the purpose of
your
trip?
They're asking you why you're leaving early.
Yeah, like, why are you leaving early? We saw that, we heard that you had an interaction out front in front of the hotel. Like, was everything all right? And that confirmed that that lady who started taking the cameras reported us to the government.
And did you find any other Americans there that, if you're at the hotel at the lobby, were there other Americans that are coming and talking to you?
Not coming to talk to me. There was other tourists. And it was interesting that these tourists, like a lot of them, they were wearing like the communist gear. Like they're wearing the shirts of Che, the communist leader. And it is so interesting that you had like all these Americans, not even that many Americans, but you had all these, I don't know where they're from, America or Europe, but they're all like pro-communist. And I'm like, how can you see what I just saw in the streets and say, let's have more of this?
Well, that's a question I keep asking myself every day right here in Canada. But that's exactly what is happening. On its face, the account of Cuba's airport having no computers and its workers having only pens and receipt paper on which to write sounds almost like some kind of comedy skit one might find on an episode of Seinfeld. But as a reality, it speaks to a degree of poverty that is almost impossible even to imagine. No wonder Cuban authorities don't want the world to see what their communist utopia looks like. Now, to a point, you might understand the lack of computers, given that the power's out most of the time. So why don't they at least use chargeable laptops? Well, maybe they've never seen one, given their fascination with Nick Shirley's Meta glasses, or given the fact that the few cars in the country are all nearly a century old. There haven't been any new technological advancements in Cuba since communism took over. And how interesting that when asked if Cuba was a communist country, that anyone would go to the trouble of saying, no, no, socialist, socialist. Remember, as clarified earlier, there's no difference between the two. Nick described Cuba's streets as empty, buildings decaying, many turning into rubble, no cars on the street. And the image accompanying this week's show, depicting the contrast between Cuba in 1958, pre-communism, with post-communist Cuba in 2022, was not so unlike the contrast between the before and after picture we featured just 2 weeks ago when depicting the same phenomenon in South Africa. From first world status to literal garbage and refuse lining the main streets and thoroughfares. And if anyone in America or Canada today believes for a moment that these same conditions cannot arise here once those same evil leftist ideologies take firm root, you're in for the shock of your life. We've already had a serious taste of this dystopia just over the past few years. I mean, consider the utter paranoia of the people who live under such a dictatorship. Says Nick Shirley, people follow you. Under communism, everyone's working for the government. It creates a whole entire society where everyone just snitches on everyone, like North Korea. Or, like Canada and the United States during the height of the COVID dictatorship. Remember all that panic buying over things like paper towels and toilet paper when the first lockdowns were being enforced? Now imagine that same condition when you can't get eggs for a year, when you're operating out of a ration book where the government controls how much food you get, where it takes years to get a chicken. Cuba's not just super, super, super sad. It is an evil and criminal regime. So the question remains, how can anyone see what Nick Shirley just saw on the streets and say, let's have more of this? Well, maybe the reason is that those saying, let's have more of this, are blind to its causes because they have not directly experienced such evil firsthand. That seems to be the opinion of Romanian TV, who on his April 14 podcast also explains how and why the history of socialism always ends up being fascist. And he does it without even mentioning Nazi Germany and Hitler's fascism of the left. We'll be hearing that assessment on this side of the upcoming bumper, while on the return side, once again, Patrick Bet-David, but this time from his May 8th panel discussion, comparing Obama's legacy with that of Trump's.
I don't think anything is more annoying in the world than an American communist, because they haven't benefited from that ideology. They have yet to embrace what they want other people to suffer. And this is something that appears on Reddit on a weekly basis. It's this annoying meme done in different forms, but the same argument. Now I have seen it on Art History Memes. And it's comparing the brutal Soviet architecture with the American suburbs. Right? And I guess because from the sky, the American suburbs look the same in the design of the house, then clearly it must be the exactly the same thing like the brutal communist architecture. Like, first of all, the brutal communist architecture, the main problem with it isn't necessarily that it's an eyesore, which it is. The main problem is that you are living in a box of matches. One of the most popular videos that I have ever made on this channel involves me walking around an apartment in one of these horrible places and showing to people just how bad it is to live there. And on top of that, whenever something breaks, whatever, let's say the building is getting a mice infestation or it needs a makeover because the paint isn't looking at it used to look like 20 years ago, it's very difficult to make the repairs. Like, let's say the basement is flooded. In order to make the repairs, you have to get 50% plus one of the people who live there to agree to pay for the repairs. And many times, some people just don't. So you end up with a nasty smell coming from the basement, rot, just things not functioning. As I mentioned before, mice infestation. It is not a good place to live. Also, take into account the fact that people didn't really have a choice. They had to live in these places. At least in my country, in the great wisdom of the dictator, he decided that people from the rural area should move to the cities because that is progress. That is how people advance, moving to the cities and working in the factory, not plowing the field. Which meant that people were physically removed from their homes without their choice and told that, okay, well, you're not going to live here anymore. You're going to live into the city. The reason the government could do that is because people didn't own their home. I know, it's like, oh, well, communists say, but yeah, but like personal versus private property. Shut the fuck up. The moment they can take away the private property, there is no reason why they wouldn't take the personal either. If you look at history and you look at almost every single socialist nation on Earth, it ended up with dictators that behave in a very fascist manner.
This comes down to Obama's legacy versus Trump's legacy. I think Obama is looking at the field and saying, I can't run anymore. That's not my thing anymore. Trump can't run anymore. I'm going to coach and train and, dare I say, groom the next socialist, Democrat socialist of America to become the next potential president of America. I think Obama is going to be very, very involved in politics, and he's going to be behind the scenes, he's going to be in front of the camera, he's going to do everything he's got to do, because all he's going to be doing is sitting there doing spring training with the Mamdanis of the world, coaching the next Democratic Socialist of America.
Obama is finished. We saw during the 2024 election, Adam, he has nothing. Yeah. That Obama factor, that change in America, it's over. Sure. It's done. And I don't care what socialist, whatever he gets behind, Adam, I think people are fed up with saying, hey, listen, you have to vote a certain way because you look a certain way.
People like Amy Acton, running for governor in Ohio, look at what she said. Look at the quotes that she made this past week. They sound like Obama. Do I think Obama's in the background there on some place like, you know, Ohio governor? I do. I think Adam's right about that. Do you think Obama's fingerprints? She practically mm-hmm. quoted Obama.
Yeah.
I think he's still out there, and I think he's influencing.
Let me know if you agree with this, Pat. I don't think Obama has the cachet to get out there and be like, do this, do this, do this. But behind the scenes, you don't think he's coaching all these guys? What do you think?
Absolutely. He's doing that. Absolutely, he's doing that.
If you just judge Obama on the surface of Obama, man, is he smooth. He's a great communicator. He seems very relatable. And I firmly believe that he tricked all of us. And a lot of us fell for it because a lot of us voted for Obama twice. If you look at politics for the last 20 years, there's two names. You have Obama and you have Trump. And everything is downstream of Obama and the Democratic Party, and everything is downstream of Trump in the Republican Party. And I'll ask you this. Behavior-wise, the way that you act, the way that you communicate, I totally understand why people empathize with Obama. He's a very smooth, suave character. But my biggest fear is that the Democratic Party has gone full-blown socialist. And you have Obama endorsing Mamdani.
I hope that's the case.
But that is.
I hope that's the case.
I know you're saying you hope that is the case. Look at that picture.
No, play the clip. Play the clip here praising Mamdani. Go ahead, Rob. Watch. I hope that's the case. I hope they go full-on socialist.
It's already there.
You have people like Abigail Spanberger and Mikey Sherrill, very centrist. Yeah. But then you have further left, like AOC or Zoran Mamdani.
Yeah. Look at that cheer for Mamdani.
What would be best for this party to actually achieve change?
I'm not as worried about this so-called rift between the left and liberals, as you describe it. You look at somebody like Mamdani. Who I think is an extraordinary talent.
Mamdani.
He wants people to be able to afford housing in New York. Well, you know, I would assume liberals in New York want the same thing. And so I don't worry as much. What I'm more interested in for Democrats is, do you know how to just talk to regular people like we're not in a college seminar?
I think that's one of the powers that Mamdani has.
That's correct.
Is that he also, not only does he talk like a normal person, but he lives a normal life.
Yeah.
But he names what is obviously wrong.
Yes.
By the way, I hope they go this direction.
Me too.
I hope they. I'm telling you, the biggest edge, any candidate has to be able to explain the tangible, intangible assets. I'm going to keep repeating this. Until the right people, when you start seeing presidents, gubernatorial candidates start explaining it this way, they're going to realize, let these socialists try to bully all they want. The biggest thing will happen, Vinny, with this idea is the following. Here's what's going to happen. The disparity, like the whole John Galt Atlas Shrugged concept, you're going to see become a reality.
You're listening to Just Right, broadcasting around the world and online. I have to admit, I was pleasantly caught off guard by Patrick Bet-David's reference to Ayn Rand's John Galt Atlas Shrugged concept, which, by the way, is already becoming a reality wherever socialist variants are found in government. What he's referring to, of course, is the flight of productive knowledge, expertise, and capital from less free jurisdictions to more free jurisdictions, meaning those where government is more a referee than a player in the game of life and economics. But let's not forget that these forces are perpetually at play, but are just not seen by most people most of the time, because it's not always easy to distinguish whether these flights of capital and manpower are caused by economic considerations or political ones. But when things become as politically poisoned as Mamdani's socialist New York, it's hard not to see Atlas shrugging. How coincidental that just as Patrick Bet-David asserted and affirmed Obama's continuing role as a socialist communist mentor, that on the very day of his May 8 podcast, Obama met with some other fellow communist co-conspirators, believe it or not, in the city of Toronto, Canada, as Canada Poly briefly reported on May 9th.
Is Saturday, May 9th, 2026. Obama visits Canada, and so he's meeting with Carney. They're having a dinner. Last night they had a dinner, I guess. And then today they're meeting with two of the top 2028 presidential candidates that may be running in 2028 against Trump. Because I'm still convinced that that guy's going to be around in 2028. I've had people independently, and I think a lot of people know that I like Trump, and I think that things are not what they seem, and the media hates Trump and they want you to hate Trump. But Obama is meeting with Carney, who's also meeting with top Democrats. And is it to strategize the next U.S. election? Because really, nobody's talking about the next U.S. election. They're talking about Donald Trump. We'll see how this whole thing works. But nobody's talking about the 2028 Democrats. They're not talking about them. So is this a strategy session for Carney? Is this a strategy session for Obama and his new lieutenants? Because it's not Sleepy Joe anymore. So we'll see. We'll see. I don't know.
Since this report, word has it that these globalist criminals, including Barack Obama, Mark Carney, and Alex Soros, are all in a panic over Trump's realignment of the world's nations back into sovereign status. And with both Russia's Putin and China's Xi having publicly announced their quote-unquote friendship with Trump on this mission, they have every reason to panic. I suppose it was fitting that this meeting should be held in Canada, where its leader Mark Carney was recently referred to as Marxist carnage by one pundit commenting on the whole affair. That's got to be the best phrase I've ever heard when it comes to describing the ideology and policies of Mark Carney. Marxist carnage. I love it. And speaking of Marxist carnage, our focus now turns to Britain, where Elliot Bewick, host of the New Culture Forum, on his May 10 podcast, interviewed Rafe Hadel Manku, a London-based author, historian, and public policy consultant. A lot of great commentary and advice here, but then, just wait for the predictable train crash when it comes to their take on the left and right polarity. And let me say, failing to resolve this left-right identity crisis is one of the main reasons that the left keeps making inroads while the right keeps asking how all this could be possible. As Ayn Rand warned, evil, not value, is an absence and a negation. Evil is impotent and has no power but that which we let it extort from us. The spread of evil is the symptom of a vacuum. Whenever evil wins, it is only by default, by the moral failure of those who evade the fact that there can be no compromise on basic principles. And evil, remember, refers to Marxism, under which every variant is leftist. For evidence, just listen to this.
It's fundamentally Marxist what we're talking about here. And one famous sociologist put it very well, and he described the way in which Marxism is a form of genus, like a cat. So a cat is the genus, and then you have various different species of cat, right? You've got lions, tigers, jaguars, tabby cats. Genuine classical Marxism was economic, and it was about the bourgeoisie and the proletariat. This was an attack on capitalism. But what we had later on, because of the rise of the Frankfurt School and Antonio Gramsci and the rise of cultural Marxism, is we had new forms of Marxism developing as a means of truly changing the nature of society, not going after the means of industrial production, going after the means of cultural production in order to change the way the world thinks. So the Frankfurt School was at the same time in Germany setting up, and they were thinking, how can we do this? And they realized, right, we shouldn't go after the means of industrial production. The left never good at running industry anyway. We need to basically go after the institutions, go after the museums, the galleries, the media, everything that shapes your worldview. If we can shape your worldview, then we are actually far more along the lines of you being likely to raise the red flag for us. Aristotle said, give me a boy of 7 and I'll show you the man. Well, now it's give me a boy of 7 to 21 when they leave university. And I'll show you somebody who's been through that process, where all the messaging they're getting is that Britain and the West have inherited privilege based upon racism. You know, they're born into original sin of racism. Slavery infects everything that's good about this country. It's all rooted in evil. All of your heroes are racist. Funnily enough, they will knock down, they want to rename David Hume's building in Edinburgh University because he had one footnote that was controversial. Meanwhile, they elevate Marx, who used the N-word every other day, if you read his diaries and everything else, vehemently racist. Somehow Karl Marx gets a clear pass on all that, despite being a grotesque racist. Che Guevara, another huge racist and homophobe, suddenly, but for some reason he's not attacked by the left, but Churchill is. And he said, you'll get to the point where you can take, if you do this to American students, you can take them to the gulags in the Soviet Union and show them the gulags, and they won't believe what they're seeing with their own eyes because they've been so indoctrinated over the course of these years. And I'm afraid that's what's happened in this country and in the West. I think woke is too soft a term for what this is. I call it American Marxism. I think that calls it out for what it is. And you'll often hear people call woke a mind virus, the woke mind virus. And actually it is, but it's a mind virus that's spread through the English language. Because these ideas, yes, they were born in Germany, they're ultimately European. Unlike David Starke, not everything bad comes from France. This came from Germany and Italy, but it was actually in America that it truly came to fruition. And what are the world's most woke countries? They're the Anglosphere countries, because they've all been influenced by American culture, by American academia, by American films, by American politics. The culture wars and race wars of America, even though the black experience in Britain is so much better than the black experience in America. I mean, black Americans used to come over here, black blues singers, Howling Wolf, Muddy Waters, soul singers like Otis Redding, they were amazed at the warm welcome they got over here, where they were welcomed into people's houses. During the Second World War, Churchill refused to allow segregation of American troops that were based here, even though the Americans wanted to. He said, no, all of our restaurants and cafes will be completely open. And black people were amazed at how this, even in the 19th century, you found this. But yet, none of this seems to be known by students in this country. Suddenly think that the black experience in America, which was undeniably racist and horrendous, somehow applies over here. That Churchill was a racist. So this is the history that's not being taught. Once you understand that cultural Marxism is another form of Marxism, and you're trying to overthrow a nation, how do you overthrow a civilization or a nation? It's by undermining all of the key foundations of that civilization and all the pillars. So as I say, original, and this is all based upon the oppressor and the oppressed, the fundamental nature of Marxism. So classical Marxism, proletariat bourgeoisie, an attack on capitalism. Then you had the rise of radical feminism, which was an attack on masculinity, but also on men, but also on the masculine qualities that built Western civilization. Then you had queer theory, which was an attack on the family, the nuclear family. Then you got post-colonial theory, which was an attack on the history of Britain and America and the West, which that's what we're talking about. And those are all combined by intersectionality, of course. And that makes a very heady mix, because you now suddenly have undermined every facet of society, everything that you could take pride in as being something that we in the West had built and achieved. And the best way to have ideological subversion, the best way to subvert society, is to disconnect people from the roots of their nation, to disconnect them from the past, have them doubting, have no heroes to cleave to. There is nothing in your past that actually should inspire you or give you that sense of belonging. What I'm talking about is the extreme far-left ideas that were mainstreamed. I'm talking about the way in which far-left radical ideas, how those ideas have now permeated society, and the useful idiots today are the liberals. This was hard-left, far-left Marxist ideology. So people are being enveloped by these ideas, which just a generation ago were far-left, and now they are mainstreamed by liberals who would never think of themselves as being far-left. And unfortunately, these are the concepts that are undermining our society. And the key takeaway I like to say to people, if you take away one thing from anything that I say, is that Britain is a post-revolutionary society.
Going forwards, what do you see unfolding, and what do you think are some low-hanging fruits we can snap up to actually move in the right direction, away from these identity politics, away from division, and seeing someone's skin color the first thing, even though we wouldn't want to and we wouldn't have 10 years ago?
Look, if you want to save Britain and the West, it is another 25-30 year process, because you have to reverse the long march through the institutions. You know, they couldn't do it overnight. We can't do it overnight. We've got more embedded in this country, so it shouldn't be as difficult. But it is a 25-30 year project. It requires us to essentially see out the current generation to dominate those institutions and educate a new generation of leaders to go into those institutions, not with a right-wing agenda, but simply to restore the balance, restore pride. And, you know, so I've also written a lecture about how you need to essentially change the school curriculum, teach history in a chronological fashion, because kids today know about the Tudors, they know about the Nazis, maybe they'll know about the settlement of the American West, nothing else. And I like to say, you know, a nation ignorant of history is like a man with no memory. And that's what we've got. We've got people who are so happy to tear down things because they don't have a clue who this individual, what this institution is. And you need to restore in people at the knowledge base so they can appreciate and judge for themselves the value of everything we have constructed in this country and in this civilization. We should also teach unashamedly Western ascendancy, why the West is the great genius of the world and how the West has lifted the world out of poverty. And we need to also teach our kids how hard it was to win the freedoms that we enjoy today. Mm. We know that more, for example, more British youth believe that it is that free speech is less important than causing offence. Mm. Now, that should strike fear into everyone's heart. Free speech should trump everything. But fundamentally, the most important thing, if you're going to save Britain and the West, apart from getting control of mass immigration, is education, education, education. And there's no point changing the curriculum. There's no point doing any of this if the people teaching this material are still going to be as biased as they are. So you need to have whole-scale reform of teacher training. This is the fundamental thing. Well, teachers are very, what they do, great jobs for a very, very, very lousy salary. Mm. But as I said, people are influenced by the fact that 90% of them are centre-left leaning. And they didn't used to be. So teacher training colleges used to be independent bodies, and they produce very good teachers. And as I said, it used to be a slight right wing, but pretty much a balance. What happened, where the rot set in, was when university departments of education took over training colleges. And university department of education, I call them woke madrasas. These are the most woke element within universities, along with sociology departments. And also bring more conservatives into teaching, just to bring some more balance in there. And crucially, bring people in from business. You know, lots of people get sick of the rat race and want to change in career in life. There are mechanisms for them to come in. And the good thing there is that business leaders, who also tend to be lean slightly centre-right, I say conservative, I mean small-c conservative, they're very good at getting to the bureaucracy and administration. And hitherto, that's been the great secret of the left. The left have been geniuses at getting onto the committees and the department heads and the boards and the hiring processes of all these institutions, HR departments, same thing within corporations and so forth. So these are the mechanisms by which you can start to retrain the youth of tomorrow, because as you know, you cannot win the battle for Britain and the West if you don't first win the battle for young minds. That's the fundamental thing in this. And there's no hope to win the war on woke if you don't have balanced, impartial kids who understand how to rationally evaluate evidence and arguments.
Mm.
And, you know, changing your viewpoint is part of the process one learns growing up. You know, there's a reason that you know, young people join gangs, they become far right fascists, they become, you know, strange young conservatives, they become passionate about all sorts of issues when they're young, just the oil, Extinction Rebellion, whether it's on the left or the right or Islam or the gangs in Los Angeles or whatever. Mm. There's a thing amongst about young people wanting to belong to something also. But when they do, cleaving to these beliefs and ideologies as if this is the gospel, there's no other interpretation of these. Nothing is absolutely pure in this world. The world isn't white and black. There's a lot of gray in the world. I don't want to make this everything into a left-right battle, because I want to bring people together as well. But it must be said again, when it comes to respecting contrary viewpoints, the left, who are so tolerant of everything else, are far more intolerant of diversity of opinion than the right are.
Mm.
And you can see this if you look in America, but in terms of how Democrats would feel again if their partner or their neighbor or their child was a Republican, or if in this country the Remainer would feel about a Brexiteer. And it's staggering, the difference between how people on the left or who are Democrats or Remainers react to meeting or having someone join their family who's a Brexiteer or Republican or who lives next door, compared to the other way around. I put it very well, because I know two MPs, friends of mine. One is Stephen Pound, Labour MP. One is Jacob Rees-Mogg. Hmm. They were both asked years ago, Stephen Pound was asked, how would you feel if your daughter came back with a conservative boyfriend? He said he wouldn't be left in the house. And Jacob Rees-Mogg said, well, I'd have him for dinner and have a good chat with him about it all. And I think that really sums up. So people need to respect and understand that people aren't evil simply for having different viewpoints. I think, you know, people stop need to treating each other as if they are somehow beyond the pale, when, of course, we all have so much that's in common. I hope that you're correct about that.
You just need to take two steps of logic to work out that oftentimes we're just disagreeing on the ways of getting to the same thing we all look for. We're all humans, and we want our family to be safe, and we want to be able to live a flourishing life. And yet we're constantly in disagreement, and we're saying that one side deserves to die, and we're celebrating their assassination. But it's like, we're fighting for the same things here, and we often forget that. It's so easy to do. But all of these arguments about morality and the implementation of stuff, it is an argument about implementation rather than a fundamental disagreement.
Wow, I hate to say it, but that is more delusional than anything ever said by anyone on the left. Talk about an absolute train wreck, and talk about an example of how these two supposed voices on the right are blinding themselves to their own words and identity. And why? Well, because I don't want to make everything into a left-right battle. That Rafe Hadel Manku could possibly say something like that after all of the previous clear polarities he had identified, such as, I'm talking about the extreme far-left ideas that were mainstreamed, how far-left radical ideas have permeated society, and the youthful idiots today are liberals. This was hard left, far left, Marxist ideology. People are being enveloped by these ideas, which just a generation ago were far left, and now they're mainstreamed by liberals, who would never think of themselves as far left. And unfortunately, these are the concepts that are undermining our society. Wow, so clearly, the things he objects to are not anything on the right, but always some leftist variant. Which, by the way, he beautifully described in his metaphor about the cat. Marxism is a form of genus, like a cat. Various species of cat, lions, tigers, jaguars, tabby cats. Yes, and every one of them is purely identified as being left, whether socialism, communism, fascism, and each variant is evil. With the acronym EVIL, E-V-I-L, expressed as every version is leftist. So what's with this refusal to identify the fundamental issues in terms of left and right? Because when it comes to the right, he calls for good teachers, slight right wing, but pretty much a balance. He notes that business leaders lean slightly center right. He insists that when he says conservative, he means small c conservative, because of course he's aware that large c conservatives are often leftists. Which brings us back to his psychological evasion, one shared with far too many on the right. So just to understand the enormity of that evasion, says Rafe, quote, I don't want to make everything into a left-right battle, but it must be said again that when it comes to respecting contrary viewpoints, the left are far more intolerant of diversity of opinion than the right are. It's staggering, the difference between how the people on the left and right are from each other, end quote. Staggering, he says. Just staggering. How different the people on the left are from those on the right. And still, despite this, he doesn't want to make everything a left and right battle. And worse, after having aligned his own beliefs with the right, he has the audacity to say that there's a reason that young people join gangs and become far right fascists. What? Now all of a sudden fascism is on the far right? Wasn't it just one of those Marxist variants he identified earlier? You know, the Marxist cat version? And if that wasn't enough to completely depress me by the utter confusion and vagueness of political terms, show host Elliot Bewick asks, going forward, what do you see as unfolding to actually move in the right direction? And although he called the direction right, the rest of their advice recommended a move that was sadly in the left direction. Like, people need to respect and understand that people aren't evil simply for having different viewpoints. We all have so much in common. Oftentimes we're just disagreeing on different ways of getting to the same thing. We're all humans and we want our families to be safe and live a flourishing life, and yet we're in constant disagreement and one side deserves to die and we're celebrating their assassination. Wow. If the quote-unquote differing viewpoint is an evil one, as all collectivist ideologies are, then those having those viewpoints are evil, and the refusal to acknowledge this is at the heart of the right evasion of the left-right polarity. I honestly think that a lot of people on the right cannot bring themselves to believe just the true nature of the evil of the left. It's the same way they couldn't believe everything that was happening during the COVID scam that was going on. It was just beyond the average person's ability to accept. We're just disagreeing on the ways of getting to the same thing, he says. No, we aren't. And you know it, but you don't want to acknowledge it, even after citing the fact that the left is saying that one side deserves to die. Really, is that the same thing that you on the right want? I mean, give your head a shake. And then the final abandonment of morality and their actual move in the left direction. As Rafe insists that nothing is absolutely pure in this world, the world isn't white and black, there's a lot of gray in the world. And Elliot, but all these arguments about morality and the implementation of stuff, it is an argument about implementation rather than a fundamental disagreement. Wow. It's hard to know just what to say and how to respond to such an absurdity without going all the way and just labeling the two of them as more Marxist variants. But they are not so unlike many, many, many podcasters I hear on the right. First and foremost, when it comes to morality, to the choice between right and wrong, good and evil, all things are black and white. And in this context, black represents the darkness of ignorance and white represents the light of knowledge. In fact, one of the key slogans of the Freedom Party of Ontario reads, "Some things are black and white," a slogan that is accompanied by, of all things, a black and white tiger, another cat metaphor, with black and white representing the opposite political polarities of left and right, or in moral terms, of wrong and right. But you could see the muddled thinking at play when Rafe called for a quote-unquote balance of ideologies to be taught in our schools and universities, even after his own determination that everything left was undermining our society. Well, if that's so, we shouldn't be allowing anything left to be taught in our schools, except as being recognized for the evil that it is. If balance is the objective, then why not teach savagery and ignorance right along with civilization and knowledge? That would be balance, wouldn't it? And even here, the whole field of education should be nowhere near any government-set curricula. Education should be an entirely private affair, from homeschooling to the highest levels of structured college and university learning environments. After all, no point in changing the curriculum if the same teachers are teaching. 90% center-left-leaning, says Rafe. And here again, the very idea that we have to wait at least 25 years of seeing out the current generations that dominate these institutions is complete and utter nonsense. You could effectively change it overnight. I don't buy the idea that when moving in the right direction, that it will take as long a process as it took for the left to infiltrate our various governments and institutions. It took the left that long because they had to lie and cheat all the way, while hiding their true intentions from their opponents because what they represent was a dystopian, nightmarish, totalitarian society. But for those moving in the right direction, towards freedom and not away from it, no subterfuge is necessary, and by simply repealing and removing almost every unnecessary anti-life and anti-production law and regulation, the speed at which a society can suddenly turn in the right direction would amaze most people. Trump has already demonstrated this in so many areas that the left is frantic to keep this knowledge away from the general public. And just to add a bit of icing on the cake, consider the recent report by Peter St. Onge on his May 5th podcast.
There is a country that slashed housing costs by 70% in just 2 years, Argentina, where right populist Javier Milei cleared a decades-long housing shortage while cutting costs 70% in just 2 years. When Milei came to office in 2024, monthly rent as a percent of income was 90% in Buenos Aires. Just 2 years later, that is 30%. Shockingly, he did the exact opposite of the democratic socialists. He eliminated rent control, simplified contracts, and protected landlords from tenant abuse. He slashed housing regulations that had mandatory 3-year leases with capped rents. Milei's deregulation sent rental supply up 170%. Rental listings tripled. 200,000 vacant units came on market. Buenos Aires housing went from Hunger Games to It's a Wonderful Life as landlords were free to offer apartments on any terms, at any price, and whatever currency they like. Now compare all this to New York, which has 50,000 vacant apartments, as in landlords don't want to rent them out, despite 165,000 families waiting for housing, and a vacancy rate of 1.4%.
Wow, don't you just love socialism? So, which will it be, left or right? And at this point in today's show, the only choice left to make is the right one. Namely, that you'll join us again next week when we will continue our journey in the right direction. And until then, be right, stay right, do right, act right, think right, and be right back here. We'll see you then.
Fade into color, color into black and white. Under the bedclothes, everything will be alright.
Each according to his ability, to each according to his means.
What does that mean?
Well, if you've got means and ability, that's a pretty good combination.
So what if I want to open up a delicatessen?
Well, there are no delicatessens under communism.
Whoa. Why not?
Well, because the meats are divided into a class system. You got pastrami and corned beef in one class and salami and bologna in another. That's not right.
So you can't get corned beef?
Well, you know, if you're in the Politburo, maybe.